This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 194, Two Guys, a Ship, and a Bourbon Bottle. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including an anniversary for The Undiscovered Country, a poll about captain swapping, and how The Force Awakens Star Trek Beyond. Then in the feature, we're joined by Daniel Prue and Kevin Reitzel to discuss the Enterprise episode, Shuttle Pod 1. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. It's really good to have you back here with me on the Ready Room. You and I see each other often. We do the orb together. We're always talking behind the scenes, but it's been a little while since you've been here with me on this show. How's everything going?
Well, Chris, God, I got to say, it's going great. It's great to be back in the 602 Club with you today. You know, Ruby's...
In the 602 Club? Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we're
Ruby
talking about some
around.
Enterprise, you know? So,
yeah, that's right.
Ruby's been serving up the good stuff. I'm really glad that we're here. She's let us use the bar. She usually, you know, reserves that just for the Tuesday nights for us to record the 602 Club, the show. But I got to say, somebody drank all the Kentucky bourbon, so I'm just having scotch tonight. But
well,
you know who that
you
was?
Know, there's a rumor going around the club. I heard that she and Tripp have everything figured out.
Oh, really? Oh, good. That's great, because I heard that her and Malcolm were a thing. So is the rumor mill really working overtime here?
Well, either the rumor mill or Ruby is really working overtime, one or the other.
I'm not going to comment.
All right. Well, let's get rolling here with some Star Trek news. And then later in the show, we're going to have Daniel from Earl Grey and also Kevin, first time here on the Ready Room with us to talk about that exact subject, the Enterprise episode Shuttle Pod 1. But before that, we're going to continue a theme that Larry and I started last week, which is talking about some of the original series films, and well, even in Next Generation last week, that are having anniversaries right now. And this time, it's Star Trek VI, which opened 24 years ago on December 6th. And I mainly wanted to talk about this one today, just because I know this is your favorite of all the original series movies. And do you remember seeing it for the first time?
Chris, I do. Now, I did not see this one in theaters. It was the family I grew up in, everything. We didn't go to a lot of movies when I was a kid anyway. But I do remember when this came out, because my friends were huge Star Trek fans. I had slowly been getting into the series at that point. And I, like you said, this is my favorite Star Trek film of the original series, but it's also just my favorite Star Trek film in general. And to this day, this is the Star Trek film that I can pop in at any moment and watch, and I just love it. And I think, for as much as I love Star Trek II, this was the Star Trek film that's so much about what Star Trek is about, which is mirroring what's happening in the world in Star Trek to teach us a lesson. But this is a lesson that I think goes beyond just you know, the United States and Russia. It's a universal lesson, and that's the mythic storytelling that's happening behind the scenes here is so much bigger than just one moment in history. And these actors were just, oh God, everybody's great in this film, you know, except for maybe Uhura, who has still had trouble with her Klingon.
Right. But luckily, she has plenty of dictionaries on hand.
Yeah, physical, real books. Strange. I'm surprised that's not just in the computer banks of the Enterprise. And we all know that Nicholas Meyer just enjoyed the silliness of that scene, of them all flipping through real books.
Yeah. But you know, yeah. That's one thing that I like about this movie is I like the feel of the movie.
Yes,
even though
yes.
Some of those things don't necessarily make sense within Star Trek and in the 23rd century on a starship. But it really works in terms of the storytelling and kind of helping connect you to the story a little bit more.
It feels like a real universe. I mean, you know, when they walk into a kitchen on the Enterprise, you know, they don't just have any kind of replicator, but, you know, they prepare real food for people,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
that
yeah.
It's better to eat healthy, real food than, you know, synthesized colored blocks. but, and even just, I was thinking about this, you know, when Kirk is doing his monologue to his captain's log and,
yeah,
he's throwing his bag around his, you know, quarters and stuff like that. It just, it feels like, you know, when you get back to your quote unquote home and you're putting things away and you don't really want to put away all your laundry. So you just kind of throw the bag in the corner. I mean, you know, Kirk's just that kind of guy.
Yeah. Well, for me, and I've probably told at least part of this story before on the Ready Room, but probably many years ago, actually. But when this movie came out, it was very timely for me because this movie, as I said a moment ago, was released on December 6th, 1991. Now, I spent part of 1991 in Moscow, in the Soviet Union, going to music school. And I actually was there during the coup when they overthrew Gorbachev.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And, I mean, I came out on the streets next to Red Square at like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and there were military vehicles all over the place, and we were wondering what the hell's going on. And then on the news a few hours later, we found out that Gorbachev was under house arrest and, you know, all hell broke loose. But by this point, I had gone back to Alabama, and the school year started at the University of Alabama, and I remember this movie being the previews coming out, and I was with my friends in the dorm, and we were all excited to see The Undiscovered Country. But on December 25th, 1991, that's the day that the red sickle and hammer flag of the Soviet Union was lowered for the last time. And when the flag went back up, it was the white, blue, red flag that we know of Russia now. And the timeliness of the story here and the mirroring of the United States and the Soviet Union and the Cold War and what was going on with the Federation and with the Klingons and the fact that the Klingons just didn't have enough money and resources to continue this conflict anymore. It was exactly what was going on with the Soviet Union. And so I always remember that because I was a Russian language major in university and a music major, and this was just so close to home for me. And so I'll always remember going to see this in the theater with my friends and my reaction to the movie and how close it was to what was happening in my own life at the time. And the other thing that stands out to me about this movie is everyone was very upset at the final episode of Enterprise. And of course, we're talking about Enterprise in the feature today. And Rick and Brandon said, well, it was a love letter to the fans.
Right,
right. Didn't really feel that way, right? But this actually, I feel, was in a way a perfect love letter to the fans of the original cast. So many things that they touched on here. I mean, you know, Bones saying, what is it with you anyway? To Kirk when
yes.
he kisses
oh,
Martin.
So you know, good.
Those little things, they were done so, so well, but you felt all the things that you love about the original series and the characters coming through here. And Nick Meyer did such a great job with it that it does feel like a love letter.
Well, and what's great about it, Chris, is you're talking about that. I'm thinking, you know, they understand that this is the last one. And who do they bring in to do that? The guy who gave us The Wrath of Khan. You know what I love about Nick Meyer? Is he realizes Star Trek isn't about trying to redo The Wrath of Khan. It's about continuing on the story of the characters that he had really, I think, in a lot of ways, Nick is responsible for creating the movie era characters. And he continues on that story with all of the other work that he's been a part of. You know, he helped with Star Trek III. You know, he's been involved enough so that he understands where these characters are. And what he does to culminate that experience of the entire original series and the movie era, and to wrap it up with the story, especially he tells with Kirk and Spock here, and Bones, is fantastic. And it is the ultimate Star Trek love letter to fans. And to me, you know, that's the ending that I think when fans complain about, say, Generations and the ending for Kirk, we expected that kind of ending for Star Trek VI, not the ending we got for Generations for that hero.
Yeah.
You know, and Kirk going out on top, but also realizing that his time is done. And it just, it's so poignant and so beautiful. And there's so many different great themes that go along with that film that it makes it a great rewatch anytime. So I encourage you, stop what you're doing, go turn on, you know, The Undiscovered Country, and then come back to the podcast and listen to the rest.
But I love that we didn't get some sort of dramatic finish, you know, like Kirk dying or something at the end of this.
Right,
just having the crew quietly on the bridge together one last time, and then they just sail off into the sunset was the best closing to me. It was actually, you know, I mean, I know my eyes were watered at the end of this movie the first time I saw it in the theater, because just seeing the signatures go across the screen and you know that's it. It was great. Mm. Also interesting, you know, little bit here is the fact that Kim Cattrall is playing Valeris in here, because Kim Cattrall is who Nick Meyer originally wanted to cast as Savick in The Wrath of Khan, and it didn't work out. And then he finally gets her and she comes back and I think plays a really nice character here.
Everything here is really interesting, and the only thing that I think would have been a really great twist, and we all know this, is if Savick had been the traitor. And obviously that's something that Gene just did not want to see. But, you know, if anything was going to make this story a little bit more powerful, it would have been that, because it would have been a character that we had been with, and you really wouldn't have suspected it. You know, unfortunately, it's too telegraphed because she's the new person. So we're all like, oh, well, who done it? Well, the new person done it, because we ain't seen her before.
But I don't think that I had that feeling the first time I saw it.
Right. Though. Yeah.
Now when you rewatch it, it's kind of obvious. Yeah, here's the new person. So, well, you know, she's kind of like, she's like the MacDuff, right, from The Next Generation. Like, who's this new first officer right here? Is something weird going on? And who's responsible?
Well, and what's great is that you buy her character the very first time you see it, I think, because if you've watched the films to that point, you trust Spock and his taste, you know, his logic. You trust that character and his intuition about people.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes that work, especially for all those fans who had spent so many years. If Spock's vouching per person, then that means they're on the up and up.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So go watch The Undiscovered Country if you haven't seen it in a while. It's one of my favorite movies as well. It's there, my top probably three or four of all the Star Trek movies. I think it's one of the best produced movies, one of the best written movies that we have. All right. So let's go on to our next item here, Matthew. It's been a while on the Ready Room since we've talked about a StarTrek.com poll, which we like to do from time to time. And the one we're going to talk about today asks which captain you would like to swap places with for a day. They only had 6,000 fan votes for this one, which is interesting because often on these polls, they'll have like 24,000 or 25,000 votes. I've noticed the numbers have been sliding recently. This one's only 6,000. But of course, you had to choose from the captains, Picard, Kirk, Janeway, Sisko, and Archer. There's no Pike there. There's no Jellicoe. No one like that. And I guess you know who won, right? It's pretty easy to guess, I think.
Really? Because to my thought, if you're going to ask this question, before we say who won, Chris, who's your pick?
Okay, well, if you asked me this question, so the question is, which captain would you want to swap places with for a day? When I think about the different captains, I think about Archer had to save Earth with a tiny ship on its own fighting against the Zindi and the Sphere Builders. Sisko had to lead the charge through the Dominion War. Janeway was lost on the other side of the galaxy and had to fight her way through Borg space or negotiate.
And failed to ask for directions.
Right, right. And if something got in her way, well, we got to go straight through it. Can't go over it. Can't go around it. And then Kirk was constantly in peril of losing his life, although he went to a lot of interesting places. Picard, on the other hand, had a massive, powerful ship. He had huge quarters. He got to sip Earl Grey. He got to eat muffins with Beverly in the morning. You know, I mean, he did have some tough situations to deal with, but overall, he had the least perilous mission, I think.
Yeah, fencing, haircut from Mott that day, you know.
Yeah, so if I were going to swap places with someone for a day and I wanted to make sure I didn't die on that day, I think Picard would probably be my choice.
See, for me, I was thinking about this question and I was like, okay, well, Archer would be cool. I mean, he's the first guy out there. That's a great person. You'd be experiencing something either new or just utterly boring every day because you're only going warp 5 or, you know, warp 4 or something, you know. So that would be an interesting one. Kirk, same thing, you know. I mean, he's on the edge of the final frontier all the time, exploring new places, running into new babes or computers to talk to death. I mean, that's exciting. I mean, to quote Scotty, I like this ship. It's exciting, you know. That's the Enterprise under Kirk. You know, Janeway. Who knows what anomaly you're going to run into? Sisko. Who knows when you're going to get attacked by a pod wraith? And yeah, you're right, Picard. Who knows which version of Earl Grey you're going to have that day? So, my pick is Kirk. That's who I would have chosen in the poll, but 38% of people who voted in this poll said that they would rather be Picard, so apparently people are thinking safety.
Maybe. And 23% chose Kirk, and he's in second. And then Janeway got 17%, Sisko got 12%, and Archer got 10%. So it really comes down to what do you want. Some people want adventure. If you want adventure, go Kirk. I think you go Kirk. If you want safety, you go Picard. And if you like beagles, well, you go Archer.
Well, I mean, with Archer, I think, you know, you've got a lot more to pursue than just that. You are pursuing the final frontier because you are the final frontier everywhere you go. Yeah. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting.
I think when it comes to Archer, it depends on which season you're talking about, because if you like adventure and you have the mind of an explorer, then season one Enterprise, it could be fun to be Archer, right? Everything's new. But once you realize how dangerous it is out there, and once you get into the Zindi conflict, well, then maybe you don't want to be Archer anymore. So I guess the bigger question here is, can we choose which day we are swapping? Can we just pick the exact day that we want?
Well, and that's the thing, you know, you don't get to choose, I don't think, just who you'd be for a day and what do they experience that day. For me, I go with Kirk or Archer, but, you know, it'd be interesting to ask what the rationale between them picking Picard. Is it just because, you know, Picard and TNG are so popular, or I don't know, but it is interesting to see that right below that is Kirk, the one that I chose, and, yeah. Who knows?
Well, let us know. You can go to the Babel Conference on Facebook, type B-A-B-E-L into the search field, and you'll find it there. That's our listeners group, and that's a great place for you to talk to us and other listeners. And this is a great topic, and then you can let us know why you would choose Picard over Kirk, or Kirk over Picard, or if you would choose Janeway, Sisko, or Archer, you can tell us why. Be a good conversation over there. And you can also find us on Twitter. TrekAfilm is the username, or go to trek.afilm/contact. That's a great way to contact us as well. Choose to send a show and choose the Ready Room. All right. So, Matthew, one more quick thing here in news. We found out that, perhaps not surprisingly, Star Trek is going to be riding piggyback on The Force Awakens to get the word out by having a trailer that runs before the film.
Well, Chris, I think this is great. Obviously, it's kind of a no-brainer because, you know, Bad Robot is producing Star Wars with Lucasfilm, and of course it's doing Star Trek as well. So anytime you go to a movie, you'll notice that all of the previews are going to be previews for films that are coming out that are linked somehow to what you're seeing. You know, when I saw The Hunger Games, it was all of these Lionsgate films that were coming out, Lionsgate. So it's the same thing here, and you know, you'll see a lot of previews for Disney things like Captain America, I'm sure, and I'm sure some other big tentpole films like Batman v Superman and other things like that will be there. But this is a great place for Star Trek. I mean, Chris, Star Wars has already made $50 million on pre-ticket sales. So everybody's going to see this movie, and if everybody's seeing a good Star Trek trailer, that's a winner. So let's just cross our fingers that Star Trek Beyond is worth people, you know, going and buying a ticket for because they like the trailer that they'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it's more people are going to see this trailer than they would attached to any other film. And I mean, you talk about how much money it's already made in pre-sales, and we did an issue for my magazine, which you wrote the feature for, actually, recently about Star Wars. But of course, normally we get to see movies ahead of time as media so that we can write about them. Well, Disney's decided that they're not doing screenings for Star Wars, so we're not going to get to see it early. But our movie reviewer needs to see it. And so a couple of days ago, we had to go, when we finally got confirmation from Disney that there would be no screenings, which was really, really late in the game, we had to go find a ticket for our movie reviewer. We could not find a ticket for the opening weekend. We finally found one ticket at 10 a.m. at a theater way outside of Tokyo. And that's all we could find. So yeah, I mean, the thing's sold out. So many people are going to be seeing the Star Trek trailer. And that's going to be fantastic. And I have to say that I think it's a great audience to show it to. If you go online, you know, people like to have this little battle of Star Wars versus Star Trek. And personally, I'm just really, really sick of the idea that you have to like Star Wars or you have to like Star Trek and you can't talk about one or the other. I mean, it's crazy. Like, we like good storytelling. We like science fiction. It's natural. I mean, we grew up, a lot of, especially people my age, we grew up on Star Wars, right? Not Star Trek. Because in the 70s, that's what
even
was...
George Lucas, you know, he said that Star Wars stands on top of something like Star Trek that he watched as a kid. So I, you know, there shouldn't be animosity between the two.
Well, that's the point. There shouldn't be animosity. You can like them both. And I think that that's perfectly fine. And so the fact that the trailer is going to run before Star Wars is a wonderful opportunity for Star Trek. So if you love Star Trek, this is great news because we need to get word out about the movie. There are many people who have watched the previous J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies who have then gone back and watched the original series and other parts of Star Trek, and it's helping us build the fan base. And so anyway, I'm really excited to hear that they're doing this and that they're not missing this opportunity, because if there's anything that's true about this next Star Trek movie, Star Trek Beyond, is that...
We need a t-shirt for that on Redbubble. We do.
Is that a lot of opportunities have been missed. The planning hasn't been great. And so at least here, they are jumping on to a vehicle that will really, really get the word out and highlight the film. And I think that it will help translate into a great box office for Star Trek. And it's also going to help, I mean, think of all the interest that's going to be generated for the new Star Trek TV series that's coming out January 2017 by people who go see Star Wars, decide, I've got to get back into Star Trek. I've got to go watch that Star Trek movie. Oh, now there's a new TV series coming out as well. So it's just great marketing.
Yeah, I mean, that's super exciting too when you think about that, Chris, with the fact that the TV show is coming out. You know, this coming out before Star Wars, The Force Awakens, Episode 7, I think if Star Trek can capture half of the audience to go see the film, they'll definitely make another one in this series. And let's just hope, I think that they realize some of the things that may have rubbed people the wrong way in Star Trek Into Darkness, but I still really like that film. I still stand by my review. I think it's a really good movie. I love Star Trek 09.
Yeah, I think it's a better movie if you're not a Star Trek fan.
Yeah, but
so you're not watching it through the lens of, hey, they're kind of matching something.
But Star Trek Beyond could be fabulous. I hope it is. And yeah. I would like to see as many J.J. Abrams, universe films that they want to do, because I think they have opened up for themselves some real freedom. And it looks like they're going to take that in Beyond. And I can't wait to see, what they've got coming for us.
I'm less rosy on it than you are there. I personally don't want to see any more Abramsverse films after this one, but I do hope that it propels the franchise forward and what we get with the TV series and just a healthier franchise. So I think ultimately we want the same thing, which is healthier Star Trek, right?
Well, and I mean, what's great is that we're going to be getting that series, so that's coming back to where we believe that Star Trek belongs. And so, if this can continue to keep the films in a place where it's in the front of people's minds, that's great. They can both work in concert to help each other out. And the same way that TNG was on the air and the TOS films were going still, it's the same kind of thing, and there were a few, two films after TNG started. So,
One of them was The Final Frontier.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other story. Anyway. We'll get John Mills on here one day, and we'll all talk Final Frontier and talk about the good parts of that. So,
well, Matthew, I just want to say that, that movie does explain why they're putting seatbelts in theaters that summer.
Well, I'm so glad they did, Chris, because there's so many times in the last 25 years that I've almost fallen out of my seat if it hadn't been for the seatbelt. So thank you, Star Trek V.
Yes,
I have to mention this, Chris. I just got the new Bye Bye Robot poster for Star Trek V. It's so beautiful. Say what you will about that film, but that poster of that scene with them at the campfire is the best one on there. So it gave us some great moments.
Yeah, that is a great poster and has a great soundtrack too. So anyway, yes, you'll be able to see a Star Trek Beyond trailer before the Star Wars movie. That's going to be really interesting to see. It's going to be interesting to see footage. They've got
footage
for a trailer now, so that's going to be cool. All right. Well, that's all we have in news. Matthew did mention that we need a Star Trek Beyond shirt in Redbubble a moment ago. That's about our store. We have a new merchandise store for Trek FM, which I also mentioned here on the show last week. If you go to trek.fm/store, you'll see some images there, and then you can click through to Redbubble. Or if you go to trekfm.link/trekfmstore, that'll also take you over to Redbubble. Or just search for trek.fm. on redbubble.com and you'll find it. But we have all kinds of great designs over there that were done by our art director, Aaron Harvey, and they're available as shirts, also as stickers and cards and mugs and all kinds of things. And it's a great way for you to support the network, because when you buy that merchandise, we do get a little bit. It's not a lot, but we get a little bit from that, and that helps us keep everything going here. So go check that out over on Redbubble. It's called The Promenade. It's the Trek FM store. One more thing I want to remind everyone about is the fact that this show is just one of many, many shows that we have here on the network. Matthew and I do one called The Orb together, which is all about Deep Space Nine. Also, Matthew has the 602 Club, which is about all kinds of geek topics. And altogether, we've got about 20 shows here on the network. And here's a quick look at those.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit. Sure, it's got the cheesy alien and the cheesy fight scenes, but that's Star Trek. I'm sorry. That's the original series.
Oh, yeah.
And no, I'm not going to apologize for it. That's Star Trek.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
To the journey!
It's very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not! Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
You know what? See, the thing is now, if Star Trek Beyond goes sideways in any way, you've planted that line in my brain. And I'm like, I only got half a peg. And I'm just going to trot that out if I don't like Star Trek Beyond.
The 602 Club.
Or staying and trying to turn this guy and almost become the mentor, and he becomes more of the student because he's insane and trying to bring sanity back to him because there's such few
Jedi.
Well, and I think that's what Luke was going to do until Mara showed up and needed his help, and she went with him.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episodes that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics, and we ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature, so I mean... Yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Treks.
You're not going to see a bunch of Klingons hanging around eating cake and you know, laughing at
well, Klingon unless chips. Unless it's a peptide cake with mint frosting.
Peptide, indeed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So go find these shows everywhere you get your podcasts. You can go to itunes.com/trekfm or just search for us in iTunes or whatever app you use. We're on Stitcher, TuneIn, we're on Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. Go to our website, trek.fm, and you'll see the show pages there where you can stream and you can download the MP3 files or grab the RSS links and pop those into any app that you like. And we have so many great things for you every day of the week here on the network. All right, Matthew, well, let's bring in Daniel and Kevin and talk about Enterprise. Some of the best episodes of Star Trek are heavy on dialogue and light on action. But to take two characters and shove them into a tiny space from which they deliver an incessant amount of dialogue for 45 minutes was a gutsy move for Enterprise in its first season. People were just warming up to the show, and we got two guys in a freezing cold shuttle pod just talking and writing letters to people, and it was a little bit uncomfortable, at least for Trip, it seemed. And today we're going to talk about this episode, Shuttle Pod 1. And to help us do that, we are joined from Earl Grey, none other than Mr. Daniel Prue. Daniel, welcome back.
Hey, Chris, it's good to be here. It's been a little while since I've been on the Ready Room, so I'm excited to fit back into this tiny shuttle pod craft, right? Shuttle pod, that's right, yeah.
This tiny little Ready Room here, right? Yeah, it has been a long time since you've been on, so good to have you back. And also joining us for the very first time on the Ready Room is Kevin Reitzel. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on here. It's a pleasure, and I'm really excited to be here with you guys talking about Shuttle Pod 1 and Enterprise.
Well, Kevin, when I invited you on the show, I did not know that you are a fellow Alabama fan, and you're recording the show in your Mark Ingram jersey right now. That's pretty cool.
I am. I'm high on their recent victory. They're going to be, going down with Michigan State for the playoffs, and I'm excited about it. Really excited about it.
Wait. And Larry's not here. This is not the locker room. No sports ball talk. Come on, guys.
I think my universal translator is completely broken. I have no idea what's going on anymore.
But for you, Daniel, this is following up last week's Ready Room, where Larry and I mentioned that we might have to get back into our Ambo Jutsu gear from the Next Generation. As it turns out, we may have to wait at least one more week before we have our Ombojutsu duel.
I would watch, absolutely.
It would be pretty cool. All right. So, Daniel, Kevin, Matthew, we're going to talk about Shuttle Pod 1 today. And Matthew, you actually chose the episode here, so would you like to do the synopsis?
Well, the synopsis is that Malcolm and Trip have been on a mission to work on the weapons of the shuttle pod and to test them, and they run into something which causes a disturbance in the shuttle pod, which leaves a lot of the shuttle pod inoperable, like communications and thus forth.
And very importantly, sensors.
Exactly, right? Sensors. So they arrive back at the place they were supposed to meet the Enterprise. They arrive early, and what do they find in this asteroid field but wreckage? And they clearly see in the wreckage a piece of the Enterprise, and it even says NX-01 on it for them. So,
well, actually, Matthew, it says 01. You can't read the NX. And so I was surprised they didn't at least consider the possibility that that might have been a door off the General Lee.
This is true. This is true. Although, you know, that's unfortunately been retired, and nobody's allowed to watch that anymore. So anyway.
Well, I think that Malcolm would love to watch a remake of The Dukes of Hazzard with T'Pol as Daisy Duke.
I could see that. I could totally see that happening.
I see a relation here.
Yep. Yeah, that would work.
All right. Go on with your synopsis, Matthew.
Well, Trip and Malcolm don't know is that the Enterprise has picked up a group of stragglers whose ship has been destroyed as they were trying to dock with Enterprise. And Enterprise is taking them home, and that's why Enterprise is not at the meeting position. Trip and Malcolm think that the ship has been destroyed. They don't have any sensors to tell really which way they're going. All comes down to everything is fine at the very, very end, but not before these two gentlemen go through, well, if hell freezes over, I'm pretty sure that's what they went through together, and they become friends in the end.
It's freezing over.
So, yeah, it's a great episode, Chris. I mean,
well, Matthew, I have to say that your synopsis sounds a lot more action-packed than the actual episode is. So, sounds like there was a lot going on there, but in reality, it's mostly just the two of them sitting there talking, and of course, we find out what's going on, and we do visit the ship just a little bit, where Hoshi gives the captain a rundown, you know, of what's going on with the aliens that they picked up, the Tesnians, as it turns out. All right, so there is our synopsis. So how about initial thoughts? Daniel, what are your initial thoughts on the episode?
Well, I actually am a really big fan of Enterprise. It's my third favorite, and I really, really, really like the first season. I know it gets kind of a bad rap sometimes, but I really enjoy the kind of storytelling it was going for. And Shuttle Pod 1 is actually one of the highlights for me from this season. So I was really excited to get in here to talk about it because it kind of, like you said, it kind of does something that a lot of Star Trek doesn't do. This feels like it would have been maybe the A plot of an episode or even possibly the B plot of a different episode. And then just kind of we would have seen more of everything else. But no, they really take this concept and run with it. And this is 95% of the episode. We get two scenes with Archer and T'Pol, and that's it. And then everything else is just resting on these two guys. And for me, it worked great because I think they have super fantastic chemistry.
Although we do get all seven cast members in this episode, at least Travis is only heard, his voice is heard.
Oh, okay.
But we do get all the cast members in this episode, which is surprising considering that when you think about this episode, you do think it's just the two guys, pretty much. But
no,
like you
no
said,
Porthos,
scene
though.
With Hoshi. No Porthos, yeah, no Porthos. Yeah, his name's not in the credits, unfortunately, at the beginning of the show. So, all right, how about you, Kevin?
You know, I remember watching Next Gen and learning about how episodes were put together with budgets. And sometimes you'd have to do an episode that was cheap on the budget so you can save for the next episode. And this was definitely one of those episodes that you could tell they needed to save budget for. you know, it has a feeling of a really good script where you're just, you can watch a really good play in a one room setting and put some good acting behind it. And it was a good character development episode for these characters too. I couldn't help think of the Star Trek Next Generation episode Next Phase, where you kind of had the optimist and the negative ninny or Debbie Downer of the two and having to work off each other and figure out how to survive.
Very good. Yeah. We'll talk a bit more about, yeah, feeling like a stage piece a bit later, because it definitely does. Actually, I think Brandon said, maybe it's in the commentary for this on the Blu-rays, that they used to joke that maybe the guys would take it on the road as a stage play. And maybe they did it. No one knows. That would be pretty cool. Well, Matthew, what are your initial thoughts here?
Chris, you know, rewatching this episode today on the Blu-ray, which just looks so good. It looks so good. I really think that this is probably one, I would say, this is probably top five of Enterprise to me, episode-wise. And not only that, but I would say this is one of the best episodes of Star Trek in general, and showing what the series can do with just a ship, two guys, and going nowhere. I mean, that's what's so amazing about this. And I was really struck by how well Connor Trinneer and Dominic Keating, their acting just shines through. These guys are so on point. They are so in character. And this is only the first season of this show. It reminded me a lot of what we got in Deep Space Nine with Miles and Julian and their friendship, and the same way that friendship works. And I just wish that Enterprise had lasted longer so we would have seen more of this with these two, because they're hysterical. And of course, they go in like 2 days and two nights they're together. And, you know, the friendship really grows as we move towards the season. But it's one I just wish we'd gotten to see more of, because this, hands down, is if it's not in your top five for Enterprise, I don't know what show you're watching, because this really is brilliant. And it's because these two guys make it work for everything that they're doing, from the fights that they have to the friendship that kindles to everything else. You buy that they're in peril. And that's a hard thing to do in, you know, a cylinder of metal that's probably, what, less than 6x5? I mean, yeah, there's really barely any room to move. So everything they do here works. And that's a testament to how good these actors were. And I think the casting for this show, because, I mean, again, this is the first season. So they had really picked two people who could, you know, act the crud out of a show.
Yeah. You said something there that gave me a title for the TV show that we were talking about on the other side of the room.
The Other Side of the Room.
When we talked about that Connor and Dominic should have their own show, or Tripp and Malcolm should have their own show, a spinoff here. I can see this on CBS. I can see the promos. Two guys, a ship, and a bourbon bottle.
Yeah, there you go. Works perfectly.
Not just any bourbon bottle, but Kentucky bourbon.
Kentucky bourbon, absolutely. Yes.
Buns and bourbon. Or bums and bourbon. There you go.
Bums and bourbon.
Bums and bourbon. It can be taken a couple of different ways, because bums can mean a few different things, but this is in the British sense, so.
Yes. That would be Malcolm's choice for sure. Yeah, I agree with what all of you guys have said. And this episode, now, I'm one of the people who likes talky Star Trek episodes. I'm much more into the character interactions and less about the tech and the space battles and flying around and such. So I'm maybe naturally the target audience for this kind of show. But I do remember the first time that it aired thinking this was a really, really great episode. And I've continued to feel that way over the years now that I've rewatched it, I don't know how many times. And it's a well-written script. It's an interesting story. It captures that pioneer sense of them being out in space. You know, they don't have all the safety nets that the Starfleet officers had in all the series that we saw up to this point. And you can kind of feel yourself. You can kind of imagine if you were a member of Starfleet in those early years and you get stuck out there and you know, well, we're probably screwed. Maybe we can make it to Echo 3, but probably not. So let's just drink this bourbon and enjoy the sea bass. I like that Tripp wants meatloaf. Of all the things that you might ask for, is meatloaf what you would specifically want out of all possible rations?
Depends on how good that meatloaf is, because I've had some dang good meatloaf, and that with a little bit of ketchup and the mashed potatoes with the gravy, that's fantastic stuff right there, Chris. You come up from Alabama. That's down home cooking right there.
Good old grits.
Yeah, I do like that they use the mashed potatoes to patch the hole so they stop losing atmosphere. That was pretty awesome. You could do that with grits too, man.
I mean, it's industrial sealant. You just didn't know that. You know, if it's been sent out long enough, good enough mashed potatoes, they can clog up any hole.
Could you imagine if MacGyver were a member of the Starfleet crew?
That'd be awesome. MacGyver would be the best engineer.
If MacGyver was on the ship, he would have made a radio out of the mashed potatoes. So they would have made a home well before then.
That's true.
He would exactly. have a Swiss Army knife. He'd be ready to go.
Yeah. And he would have used that candle and the bourbon to create some kind of warp engines. Definitely. All right. Well, those are the initial thoughts here. So let's get more into it and talk about the fact that this is a bottle show. It's what I call a very small bottle show because, again, the shuttle pod is so tiny. They built that shuttle pod there on the stage. And they actually built like walls around it and lowered the temperature to make it cold inside to help get the effect. Primarily, they say, to help get the effect of the breath, that it was very cold because at the time that they did this episode, they couldn't really do that with CGI. And I was thinking that I think you could do it with CGI at this time on a major motion picture, perhaps, but on a TV budget, what they had to work with, you know, probably it wasn't very practical to do. So they literally made a bottle show out of this by sticking the actors into this incredibly cramped space. And David Livingston has said it was very, very difficult to shoot this episode because you really didn't have anywhere to move the camera in that tiny space. So, Daniel, what do you think about the concept here of doing this kind of story? We've seen a lot of bottle shows, and I mean, doing TNG, you guys do Earl Grey. TNG did a lot of bottle shows to save money, but never anything as literally small as this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the bottle shows on TNG, you've got like five or, you know, four or five giant sets already anyways. So it's like, it doesn't even feel claustrophobic because that ship isn't supposed to feel that way. So even the bottle
still
the bottle
feels
shows,
like the Hilton.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, yeah, oh yeah, you know, you can go into the into the ballroom, and oh yeah, it definitely feels like a bottle show. No, it doesn't feel like that even.
They should have had like a baby grand piano on the bridge over in the corner with someone just playing.
Just have Billy Joel over there playing things. Burt Bacharach shows up every once in a while.
Yeah, you know those sections that they didn't have that appeared in Generations? That's those things kind of fold down, and that's where the pianos are. They actually
that's where the piano
that makes
pianos,
sense.
Yeah.
You have the saxes on one side, the piano on the other.
Riker on the trombone in the middle.
Yes,
yeah, that
exactly.
totally makes sense.
That's how we would know, like in yesterday's Enterprise, we would know something was different because instead of a piano, it would be like an electric keyboard, like a DX7 or something over there.
Or a battle piano.
Battle piano.
No, that's the thing. Like on the battle bridge, they have just an upright piano because they don't have space for the baby grand.
It's a little more cramped to come. And you know, I joked in the beginning of the show, but because like the shuttlecraft on TNG are much more simplistic in nature. It's more like a cardboard box with some seats in there. I did actually like this set. I like the set that they built because it does feel small and cramped, but it's also it seems practical in a lot of ways and well thought out. So to me, it really makes sense. But you're right. We've never seen it on this scale where literally if you were in there with these two actors and the camera guy who is presumably right there too, like you would feel claustrophobic. Like it was probably that tight. And a lot of the shots that we get make you feel that way. And it definitely added to the atmosphere. I really, really liked that aspect of the show.
I like that the interior of that shuttle pod actually feels like a spacecraft, like something NASA might build, because if you look inside the space shuttle cockpit, you've got all those controls all over the place. But like you said, with TNG, it's like a couple of chairs stuck inside a little room, pretty much.
Well, they even do that wonderful thing where they're flying over the asteroid, and they show you that the shuttle pod is upside down, quote unquote, to the asteroid. So they're showing you that how things actually work in space. There's no up and down. You know, we only see that because the actors look right side up, because that's how we're used to seeing people on television. But I love that in Enterprise, they were really starting to play with what it's like to actually be in space. And then, geez, you know, talk about a bottle show. When they show that tiny little shuttle pod making its way through the vastness of space, and it just looks ridiculous. I mean, like, what is this little thing? It's like having a dinghy out on the middle of, you know, the Pacific Ocean, in the middle where there's no islands for thousands of miles. That's exactly what it feels like. And they pull it off just so well.
It's funny you mentioned the dinghy in the ocean, because the feeling that I got, obviously a very claustrophobic feeling, but you know, I grew up on World War II movies, watching them with my dad, and I started thinking about the submarine films, Das Boot, Run Silent, Run Deep. And you know, a lot of those, you know, whether they were shot on a soundstage or something like that as well, they really got the feeling of claustrophobia. And there was always leaking water. Sometimes it was very hot in there. This was the opposite, of course. It's in space. That was the feeling that I was get from it. And it was shot very, very well in a very tiny space. And it you know, I would love to have seen some of the behind the scenes, like, you know, some of the camera positions and how they were able to pull that off, because I felt like I was crammed right in there with them.
I love on the Blu-rays, because the resolution is so high that you can see how they have frost on the control panels. Mm-hmm. And when it's getting really cold, also the color scheme of the interior, the blue, the gray, the green on the display screens with the frost over it, it just looked very beautiful.
I thought the opening shot was great too, where you see the camera behind the console that Trip is working on, and then over his shoulder you see Reed talking about, you know, reading Ulysses. And I just thought the opening shot was great. So they, you know, that set you know, must have been a challenge to build, not just for the actors but for the camera positions as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I do like too, Matthew, what you were mentioning. And I had the same exact thought when the shuttlecraft goes to kind of see the wreckage on the asteroid. Goes to see the wreckage and literally does, I guess, kind of a barrel roll, right?
Oh, is that our first, like, shuttle pod barrel roll ever? Like, is this the only one?
It's the earliest known spacecraft barrel roll, I guess, Starfleet history, yeah. I had the same thought. I'm like, wow, this is cool, because it makes sense that they would have to do that. And it makes sense as an Enterprise thing, because it's early on and we're exploring space, you know, kind of for the first time. And then it also makes sense through the story, because, well, they don't have sensors. They literally, all they have are their eyeballs. Yeah. And that really adds to the story as well. And it kind of also sets it up that it's believable that they think that this tiny section of the ship is the entire ship, because they don't know. They can't tell, really. And so I always thought that was actually really, really good, too.
You know, initially, if you miss the line about their sensors not working, you feel like, shouldn't they scan? Shouldn't they check more to make sure that it's not just a piece of the ship, and that a piece of the ship came off, but the rest of the ship's out there somewhere? But then, of course, you realize, well, no, but their sensors aren't working. But could they have gone in closer to the asteroid, done a visual survey, to make more of a check to see, is there enough debris here? Especially Trip as an engineer, is there enough debris here to account for the entire Enterprise? Is there any debris that we can see in space in the general vicinity here? And maybe they wouldn't have immediately jumped to the conclusion that the Enterprise had been destroyed and all their crewmates were dead.
I imagine that would be a tremendously, tremendously difficult thing to do by eye, especially in space. And if there's one thing this episode is teaching us about space, is that it's huge, right? And kind of
space is big, really big. Yeah, you just won't believe how incredibly big space is.
Exactly. And so there's, I kind of had that same question too in my mind, like, well, come on, guys, there's one panel here and a little bit of debris, but who knows? If it had exploded over the asteroid, the rest of it could have gone out into space. They would never know. I mean, given the information that they have and the options that they have, I kind of reconciled it in my head that, yeah, that's a totally reasonable conclusion to come to.
Well, not only that, but I'm thinking they're in an asteroid field as well. So if Enterprise has exploded for some unknown reason, and the warp core has been breached, I mean, that explosion is massive. So the fact that they don't have very much debris, that's the largest piece, kind of makes sense. Not only that, but I mean, then it's ricocheting and exploding all through the asteroids and probably getting pulverized as it moves through. I mean, to me, I was like you, Daniel, I was kind of rationalized, okay, this makes sense that they would come to this conclusion because of where they are and they only have visual data. I really
they find like stickers of data on the panels inside. Let's play visual data.
Oh gosh.
You know, the asteroid worm could have been very hungry that day and ate
that's
most
very
of the debris,
true exactly, you know, so. You never know when it just comes out and swallows a Millennium Falcon whole.
I wasn't completely satisfied with the conclusion that they, you know, thought that the ship was destroyed. There wasn't enough detective work for me personally. I think they kind of on first reaction and kind of went with that. Of course, then we wouldn't have the show that we have. But, you know, I guess they wanted to get right into the character development there. And they had to kind of go with what their first reading was, you know, whether it was visual or whatever they did have there. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't completely satisfied of the quick analysis of what they just saw.
Of course, the episode wouldn't work if they spent more time investigating, right?
Yes. So
well, and I think at that point, they are also, again, it's realistic. They are weighing how much time they have left in this universe because of air consumption and what the probabilities are of, is this the Enterprise? And obviously, since they can't contact them because their receiver and transmitter is down, then their options are very limited. So it's like, do we stay here and die, or do we at least go try and find a way to live? Because we, you know, we have this hypothesis, we have this data, we put it all together. This is the theory. So, I think it's actually written pretty well to say they have two choices: they stay there or they go, and they choose to go because that gives them probably the best chance, especially if Enterprise is destroyed, to live. Even if Enterprise isn't destroyed, Enterprise can still pick them up on sensors because they're not going to get that far. So it's not really a win or lose thing. It's kind of a win-win thing at this point. That's how Tripp's taking it. Malcolm's taking it. It's a totally different thing.
And that's the point. I mean, we can talk about whether they should have investigated more or not in reality if this were really happening. But the episode is about hope versus pessimism. So we have to set up the situation where Malcolm thinks that they're doomed. It'll be like Linus in the Peanuts. I'm doomed. And then you have Tripp, who's being very optimistic, the good old boy. He knows he's going to get some more catfish eventually, right? He's going to be okay. But before we talk about hope versus pessimism, just building upon them making that decision that the Enterprise has been destroyed, they then very quickly begin to fight with each other. And this was another thing that I found a little bit odd. Now, of course, for the purpose of the episode, you have 42 minutes to tell a story. So you can't spend too much time setting it up. But as Starfleet officers, even in the 22nd century, when you think of all the training that military officers would go through even today, I felt like they started turning on each other and getting frustrated with each other very, very quickly. Did you have the same feeling, or do you think it's realistic that they would jump on each other so fast?
I think to get to the story, they had to jump on that real quick. The one thing that kind of stood out to me was Reed's realization that his family, which was the Enterprise, is gone. You know, and you let that sink in for a second. You know, he doesn't have the experience that Tucker has, and everything that he knows and loves and calling home is gone. So he's quick to dive right into that pessimism.
Yeah.
I didn't have too much of a problem with it. I think watching the episode the first time around, you know, back when it originally aired, it just kind of made sense for the 22nd century, you know, that's what they were going for is a group of people who are going to be a little bit quicker to jump down each other's throats than be, you know, kumbaya like the Enterprise D crew, you know, where nothing ever gets in the way of them being all happy and go lucky. So it's actually kind of nice to see that, you know, that these are real human beings. And I mean, when you're faced with annihilation by freezing to death in a shuttle pod, it's not surprising that these kind of things come out. And it was a good way to quickly get to who the different characters are, just internally, you know. Trip, the eternal optimist, and, you know, Malcolm is the eternal pessimist in a lot of ways. And that's because of their life experience and where they've been and what their family lives have been like. And all that psychology really comes into play very quickly, but just with, you know, a few moments of dialogue. And to me, that's some really great writing to be able to infer a lot about these characters very quickly in the first season. It's disappointing that Enterprise didn't have more time to spend like this with its characters in general in the first and second seasons, really just diving into them, because they're truly interesting. I mean, they really are fascinating characters when we, you know, start peeling back those layers.
Well, and those characteristics of Reed and Trip both carry through the series, right? You said that Reed is the eternal pessimist and Trip is an eternal optimist. And I think that holds true fairly well for these characters. It's not something fabricated just for this story. It's really who they are, and we see that all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Chris, though. This time watching it, like, I get why they do it, but the scene where Malcolm is kind of irritating Trip, and, like, where they actually go from just, like, I'm slightly frustrated and annoyed with you to I'm going to yell at you now, is it's a little fast. But I understand for the story purposes why they had to do it that way. But I was a little taken aback by the fact that, like, wait a minute, guys, it's been, like, maybe 4 hours since the disaster happened. If we're like freaking out now, we're definitely not going to survive any sort of crazy circumstances at this point.
I think if this had been like a TOS episode where they had 52, 53 minutes to tell a story, you get that extra 10 minutes, then you could make it transition a little bit more realistically.
But this is the same kind of thing too. I mean, I can totally see Bones yelling at Spock. You know, if this is a Bones and Spock episode and they're in the shuttle pod, Bones is totally yelling at Spock, you know, move, damn it, we gotta, you know, get somewhere, you know.
Like, yeah, but that would build upon the relationship. That's the dynamic of the relationship between Bones and Spock, but I don't think that this is the dynamic of the relationship between Trip and Reed.
It's funny, though, I can see Spock reading Ulysses, but I don't see Bones reading Superman. But that was one thing that I liked about that, was that I think this was the episode two. I remember I really kind of started gravitating towards Trip being my favorite character of this cast. You know, he kind of reminded me of the McCoy, but it did seem to kind of escalate, you know, when they started snapping at each other. Of course, you know, Reed doesn't, he takes really quick to kind of go down the Debbie Downer road there very quickly. And I've been at part.
That needs to be a thing on the Ready Room, the Debbie Downer.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been at parties where someone will turn to the Debbie Downer, and that'll change the mood of a room quickly. And that's just what it's doing. It's just a smaller audience.
Yeah, I have to say, Kevin, I am glad that you brought up the reference, because I know that both Matthew and I are actually what you would call super fans.
Yes, yes, we
although,
are.
Although only one of us can be a super Dan. Sorry, I had to go there. But no.
I need a sound effect for that.
So I did like that, actually, you know, the reference there. It seems like Malcolm, maybe it's because to me Trip is more likable. It just, the actor, the character. Yeah. I do like Malcolm, but Trip is just infinitely just more relatable and more enjoyable to watch. And like, it seems like Malcolm is going out of his way to kind of to be ridiculously pessimistic. No, you don't understand. Like, I never got to touch T'Pol's bum and like all of this stuff. And it's like, it's totally crazy. It's like crazy. It's just crazy.
So well, that's the one thing. So if he had that opportunity, he'd be okay with this being the end?
I think so, yeah. He could die happy, man.
And that's one of the things that I really liked about this episode is it was showing the subtle prejudices that still exist in humanity. You know, Malcolm's European superiority complex
against North
Americans was really nice. But you can the way he's kind of digging at Trip, you know, it's kind of understandable why, again, Trip like snaps at him and starts to yell because Malcolm has this, I'm better than you are. I've accepted the realities, you know, and nobody gets on people's nerves more than the Mr. Know-It-All pants in the room. And Malcolm is definitely Mr. Know-It-All pants in this episode.
Well, Matthew, I mean, look, Malcolm's got a case. I mean, British schools, they have a core curriculum. So, of course, he's better than
Trip. That's true. I mean, he's read Ulysses more than once, apparently. So, good for him.
So, Matthew, are you going to be doing another 602 episode where you really dig into how Superman was laced with metaphor?
You know what? Dan and I were both on an episode where we talked about that, number 15, yeah. Man of Steel. So I think everybody can check that out. But, you know, I think that was something that was... It was a nice way, again, to show the difference between where the characters are here in the 22nd century and how we're still kind of, you know, we've gotten rid of war and disease and all that thing, but there's still some things in there about humanity that have to be refined, you know? Yeah, and, you know, even by the time we get to the Next Generation, Picard still is very proud to be a Frenchman, even though he's British. You know, he's proud of his heritage and all of those things. So those are things that never go away. Kirk was proud to be from Iowa. You know, I mean, all of that stuff that's ingrained in us is still kind of there. And it was just a nice little homage to the fact that no matter where we go, you take home with you wherever that's from.
Yeah, even in the 23rd century, Kirk was still trying to find a way to talk to his kids about an undefeated Iowa.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just had to throw that in there this year.
Nice reference there.
Well,
there you go.
And what's great here is that, you know, Malcolm is the eternal pessimist, but and I love that somehow Trip is like, you know, Bilbo Baggins.
I'm going on an adventure!
We're going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine. Nobody's going to die. And it is... I guess the argument of the episode is which one of those kind of ways of living is either better or do you just need both of them to keep each other grounded? And I think that becomes the thing. Like, both of these characters, I think, bring each other to a place where they're more grounded, but they also help each other think the best. You know, like, that's really cool.
I mean, I agree that if we talk about hope and pessimism or... Maybe I should say optimism and pessimism. I say hope and pessimism in this episode because Trip, he's being optimistic, but he also has the hope that they're going to be rescued, whereas Malcolm is not only being pessimistic, but doesn't even consider the possibility that there's any hope that they will be. It's just a foregone conclusion for him. And I agree that in a relationship, whether it's a marriage or just a friendship, whatever it is, that you do need that to keep everyone grounded. It is helpful to have someone who's very optimistic, but someone who is pessimistic or at least looks at the possible bad outcomes of a situation. Because if you're overly optimistic, then you can find yourself in a situation where you don't have the things that you need in order to survive because you've just believed that it's all going to work, it's all going to work, it's all going to work. But at the same time, someone who takes a pessimistic view or at least is considering the bad outcomes too much, I think has trouble getting themselves into a good situation. So having the two together can help you find a happy ground.
I will say that this episode reminded me a lot of famous you know, kind of disaster stories, and space themed ones, of course. Namely, I was thinking a lot of Apollo 13 when I watched this episode, and then more recently, The Martian. So where Tripp was essentially trying to science the, you know, the stuffing out
the bleep
out of the
it,
situation.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, while I, you know, I see what you guys are saying, we're kind of there's an element of yin and yang, and you need to have both elements there. I definitely think that Tripp was more, in my mind, Tripp was more in the right and Tripp was more in the Star Trek ideal. And he brings Malcolm to that, especially at the end of that episode. You know, when Malcolm finally like decides, well, how can I help? Let me think of ideas. Like, oh, can we destroy the engine? And can we do this and this? Like, eventually he kind of like wears him down and with positivity, I guess. And then eventually, you know, that kind of wins out. And really that's what saves them.
So this was kind of Star Trek's first, let's eject the warp core, right?
It kind of was, yeah.
But he only gets to that point when Hoshi gives him a new hope. So, you know, she comes on the comm and gives him the message that gives him the lifeline, gives Malcolm some hope.
Yeah, yeah. So when I was saying that having both sides is a good balance, I do agree, Daniel, that in this situation, for me, Malcolm is way too pessimistic. Like, I don't think that it is in keeping with the tradition. Well, at this point, there isn't really a tradition. They're the first ship out there. But for us as viewers, what we expect from Starfleet officers, I would really, really expect someone who the captain of the first Warp 5 ship chose to be one of his senior officers. I would expect that person to have more fight in them, not to give up so easily as Reed does. But we see, I mean, Reed is like this. You look at, say, Minefield and how you talk about Tripp being a very likable character and Reed maybe not being a likable character. Reed's kind of mopey, just he's always feeling bad for himself, feeling sorry for himself. He's going to give up in Minefield. He thinks he's being noble, right? Like, I'll sacrifice myself for the ship. But it's not necessary to sacrifice himself for the ship. And that's sort of his personality. And here he really goes to that place way too quickly.
I think that Reed, after watching the end of this episode, I kind of envision the scene at the end that we don't see where Reed learns from this. He learns that he was quick to jump to "we're doomed." And I can just see that, you know, he and, you know, Tripp looking at each other going, look, if you don't tell anyone what I said or did, I'd appreciate it. I'll learn from it and I'll move on. And I can see those guys having a scene together saying, yeah, well, look, we learned something out of this. We learned about each other. And
we've learned who's your type, Malcolm.
Yeah, exactly.
Apparently everyone is Malcolm's type. But what's
everyone
great is
Malcolm's type.
What's great is that what happens in the shuttle pod stays in the shuttle pod.
You know, I'm sure he has the Starfleet version of Tinder somewhere. So, yeah.
Space Tinder. Yeah.
He definitely like, has a girl in every port.
Yeah. Right. It's like, so-and-so is in your sector and looking for a date.
Oh, I can awesome. See, though, an Andorian this time.
No, but right this way. would be in TOS, Space Tinder would be like, she's the only girl in the quadrant.
Swipe hologram, right? Swipe hologram.
Just like the Enterprise is the only ship.
Would Space Tinder be called Impulse, maybe? That's the best I can come up with. I don't know.
Transporter.
Transporter. So the hope and pessimism debate, we really get into that thanks to the fact that this episode is pretty much all talk and no action. And as I said up front, some of the best Star Trek episodes are like that. I know for us, Matthew, The Visitor would come to mind, where it's very, very much a talky episode, one of the best episodes on DS9. But there's just so much dialogue here. As fans were trying to latch on to this new series, especially coming off Voyager, which had really become much more, you know, the episodes are much more action-oriented, do you think that this was a really risky move for them to put out an episode like this?
Well, they definitely weren't following the wonderful advice of Elvis Presley, which is a little less conversation, a little more action, please. This has all talk, but at the same time, you know, I was thinking about this today because I thought you would bring this question up as I was watching the episode. I kind of expect a first season to be full of episodes like this, where we're really diving into the character. And this isn't just a talkie where we're just getting talk for no good reason or techno babble. We're actually really going to dive into characters and come to understand who they are in 42 minutes. You know, I understand completely who Trip is and who Malcolm is at the end of this episode. And even if I never got to spend any more time with them throughout the rest of the, you know, 3.5 years, I know more about these characters and who they are than I do about a lot of other characters in all of Star Trek. And it's just because they really spent time using this situation to bring out who these characters are. And it doesn't feel forced. It just feels completely organic. And this is just a fantastically written episode. And it's, you know, Berman and Braga writing this episode, the guys who helped, you know, they created this show, so they know these characters best. And this is some of their best work I've ever seen. And so, I don't know, does action doesn't mean I learn anything or I know anything about the characters or the show itself. And this really, I think, just sets up the 22nd century and sets it apart from all those other series so well in that sense. So I think this is kind of the perfect move for a first season, but that's just me. And I even, you know, I liked this episode then and I love it now. So it's only become one of those that I watch more and more and more. Like, if I pick out season one, this is definitely going to be a rewatch.
I like the fact that you said that because, you know, a common thing for people to say is, you know, that episode was so Star Trek. And this is something you want to see in the first season. And one thing I wanted to mention was, of course, this was a Trip and Reed episode, but don't overlook that great interaction between T'Pol and Archer, where Archer's throwing out, you know, gremlins and the micro singularities. Vulcans would blame that, you know, the common cold on that. And yeah, you know, their relationship between those two are butting heads right from the get-go. And that was a wonderful little scene, even just between those two, that you kind of see this mutual respect. And it makes you kind of wonder, like, T'Pol is not like Data, where Data can kind of like stop, tilt his head, search his data banks. T'Pol's going to probably have to go back to a room and look up gremlins and wondering what he's referring to. And, you know, this was one of those scenes too that made me think about Archer, and it really made me gravitate towards him as the perfect captain for this. You know, he's relatable. But I wanted to bring up that scene there because you're right. This is a well-written show. This is a character-driven show. And this is what you want to see in season one.
A connection I had never made in Enterprise in any of my previous watches is Archer's attitude towards microsingularities mirrors T'Pol's attitude towards time travel later on in the series, like, mm-hmm. totally, completely. And I never, like, it's not anything that's like super blatant, or like, unless you're watching those episodes kind of back to back. And I was like, wow, that's cool. Hey, you know what? Here's your healthy dose of skepticism. Oh, guess what? I have some too. There you go.
I thought of microsingularities as being like the Enterprise equivalent of anomalies on Voyager, and it's sort of Archer commenting on Voyager about, oh, an anomaly? I guess you'd blame anything on that.
Yeah.
I love that you pointed that out, though, Daniel, because I saw the same thing, and I was thinking, huh, just a few, you know, like a season later, we're going to kind of hear about that with T'Pol and Archer, but it's going to be reversed about time travel. Yeah. That the Vulcan Science Directorate finds that to be implausible and improbable. And he feels the same way about these singularities. And, well, they both learn their lesson. So I thought that what's interesting is that, again, this episode is so very Star Trek that they're discovering something that other series obviously know about, but they're out there for the first time. And nobody, even the Vulcans, haven't made the discovery that microsingularities are a thing. They've just postulated they are. And it's, you know, these humans that happen to run across them and make the discovery. I think it's pretty awesome.
I think what's an interesting contrast there in T'Pol and Vulcans not believing in time travel versus Archer not believing in micro singularities is that from Archer's perspective and from the human's perspective, they really don't have any evidence for micro singularities, perhaps. And for them to believe that would be pretty difficult at this point. It's certainly understandable that they might dismiss them. The Vulcan position on time travel, on the other hand, I think is more like the Vulcans willfully deciding that they don't believe in time travel, even though the evidence for it exists. And that's a difference there for me. They've just decided, nah, we're not going to believe in that. There's no way.
Yeah, it does seem awfully dogmatic in their like absolute refusals to even accept that it's like a thing. But it was just interesting to me because I had never thought of that. And he was like, nope. Nah, couldn't be that because that's not a thing. And she's like, well, we have this data here. Do you want to see it? And he's like, nah.
Right. But don't show us any time travel data.
Yeah,
we don't believe that. Exactly. That's all
people
fabricated.
Just don't like
stuff
data.
Right,
it's weird. Poor guy.
Okay, well, we're very quickly heading towards an hour, much more quickly than the shuttle pod was making its way to Echo 3. And we have a few more things to talk about here. One being Malcolm's fantasies and realities. The fantasies, of course, being the first time that he wakes up in sickbay when he's dreaming or hallucinating, and T'Pol is over his bio bed. At which point, I think that Malcolm was going to quote Elvis Presley there for you, Matthew. A little less conversation, a little more action, please.
Oh, jeez.
And not to mention, call me stinky, please.
Yes. But I like how Jolene plays T'Pol in these moments that we see through the series where she's out of character. Like, it's someone's dream. We get that again with A Night in Sick Bay, for example. How she plays sort of the sultry Vulcan.
She's preying on the ideas that everybody has from Vulcan Love Slave, the original, at that point. So,
right.
That's very funny.
Actually, I think at this point, Vulcan Love Slave was probably just a short story, right? It hadn't been turned into a full-blown
That's right. It's not a full-blown novel at that point. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just fanfic. It's just fanfic.
Yeah, just fanfic. Right.
Just on the internet. People started writing after First Contact there in Montana. People
Wait,
started
Vulcan,
writing.
Vulcan these
short
Love
stories.
Slave is the 50 Shades of Grey of the 22nd century.
Exactly.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Red. of Rust Red.
Great. Now I'm envisioning her playroom somewhere on that Enterprise.
No,
no, no.
Right, it's right next to the sweet spot, I think. Yeah.
That's why Travis is always up there. He's actually, he's the predecessor of Argyle on the Enterprise D. He's drilling holes in the wall.
Yes, the acoustics are really good in the sweet spot.
Oh, goodness. Wow. Oh, Char's going to be so proud.
I think it's funny that a tipsy read is basically a translation for what the audience has always been thinking, and they're just saying it out loud.
Well, and you called it on the other side of the room, Daniel. I mean,
the other side of the room.
T'Pol looks nice in her yoga pants, and that's basically what she's wearing is a yoga outfit all the time on the Enterprise. And so, but you know what I like is that you know these guys are respectful of T'Pol. You know, when they're around her and when obviously they're drunk and they think they're going to die, it's okay to be honest and say, she's a good looking woman. And that's not a bad thing to recognize that she's a beautiful woman. And what I love about Malcolm is, you know, he's an equal opportunity guy. You know, he doesn't care if they're Andorian or they're Vulcan or their name's Ruby or whatever. It, you know, he's willing to give them a chance, you know. And, you know, it that was another interesting scene because even there, Trip just dismisses her out of hand because she's a Vulcan and he doesn't see her that way. At least until neuropressure starts. And I really like that because, again, they're playing subtly on the prejudices that humanity still does have that they're going to have to work through. And even in a silly scene like that, where we're talking about whether, I mean, obviously this doesn't pass the male Bechdel test because these guys are just talking about a woman a lot.
I like that, the male version, yeah.
But I do like the honesty of it, of being able to say she's a beautiful woman. And there's nothing wrong with recognizing that fact. But the scene is a lot deeper than just that, because, again, we learned something about Trip here that he's definitely going to have to overcome before him and T'Pol can, you know, move into the relationship that they start to have. You realize this guy has a lot to overcome when it comes to Vulcans, just like Archer does.
I'm sorry, Matthew. I thought you were going to say you learned something about Reed, that he's a bum man, too.
Yeah, well, yes. he is a bum man.
That's true. And you said Malcolm is an equal opportunity guy. You forgot about Ruby, because, of course, he's known Ruby more times than he can remember. And with him telling that to Trip, and also with him talking about T'Pol to Trip, I love the reactions that we get from Trip. It's just, we've talked already about how natural this whole episode is, because it is very well written, but it's also very, very well acted, and it just seems so natural, like two guys, and especially the way Connor plays his role just seems like two guys having a chat. It doesn't really feel like a script, and as complex as the script is, Connor mentions on the Blu-ray commentary that this was actually one of the easier scripts for them to memorize.
It seems so natural for the way that they would just talk. And what I love, too, is, you know, the way that Trip delivers his line there, you can kind of tell he is more of that Southern gentleman. He's a one-woman kind of guy. He thinks about one woman at a time. That's, I mean, with the way he talked about Ruby, this was, you know, this was the girl of my dreams, you know, so, which is very different than Malcolm, who, Ruby was one of many that I've had many times. You know, that's just not how, you know, the difference between these two guys. And you can kind of tell, you know, when, and again, I love that there's a deeper part of this conversation, because when Malcolm's saying all those things, and then he talks about how he couldn't get close to these women, this guy's been trying to fill a void in his life with all of these women, with all these people. And it's only started to be filled by the relationships that he's created on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And that's a really, again, psychologically, it's a really interesting thing to do. And it's couched in what could be considered more silly conversations or just man talk. But there's a lot more going on here if you dig underneath the surface.
Well, and I think when you see how Reed reacts after he has downed Dorton's best, you can tell that he's like really, he has a wall up all the time between him and other people. Like he's really trying to portray a certain image and maybe protect himself. Cause like you said, maybe he hasn't been able to get close to these people, and he has had a lot of disappointments in his life, it seems. And even when he writes a letter to his parents, you get the feeling that his parents also are disappointed in him in some way as well. And so he has this wall up, but when they get the bourbon in them and he really lets his guard down, you see a very different Reed.
You could have just called the show Bourbon Confessions.
Bourbon Confessions, yes.
Well, I also
that's
think
the name
learned
of the episode is the shuttlecraft. Yeah.
Bourbon Confessions.
I also think that we learned something about Ruby as well, because if Trip was you know, thinking about Ruby, was he thinking about Ruby at the same time that you know, Connor was?
Probably.
You
know? Probably. I mean, you know, Ruby, she serves up a good drink.
Well, coming from the 602 Club, she does.
Right. All right. Let's talk about one last thing here as we pass an hour. On the Blu-ray, there is a deleted scene. It's actually not exactly a deleted scene. It's a portion of the scene that we get. It's actually the scene in which Reed mentions T'Pol's bomb. But before that, there's this very lengthy, I didn't time it, but it's probably like 3 minutes or so, of Trip telling Reed about the time that he and Archer went diving. And it's a really great piece. And it's one of those things that's not really cut, I think, because it doesn't work, but they just maybe needed to shorten the episode up a bit. And so they lifted that out. But when we talk about learning about the characters here and how much this episode tells us about Reed and how much it tells us about Trip, originally, it also told us a lot about Trip and Archer, and I think it's some things about them that we maybe don't really learn until we get to First Flight, when we really find out their history together. But this bit here about when they went diving and the jokes that Trip played on Archer, and how Trip always felt that Archer was sort of like this Starfleet superhero to him. You know, he could always do everything better than anybody else. I think it shows why Trip has so much respect for Archer, and also why Archer would bring Trip aboard the ship. Did you guys have a chance to see the cut scene here?
I watched it today, and I love that scene because, you know, Trip mentioned Superman earlier, and he thinks of Archer as Starfleet Superman, you know, and it makes sense. You know, I don't know if everybody's experienced this, but I think most people have, where you have that guy that you know, and he's probably a good friend of yours. Like, my best friend is just like this. The guy picks up a guitar, and like 30 minutes later, he knows how to play. You know, he's good at all the sports. All the girls like him. You know, he is that Supermanish type person. Like, everything he does just seems to go right. And yet, at the same time, you utterly respect him and you'd follow him to the ends of the earth. I mean, I feel that way about my best friend. And I think Trip feels that way about Archer. And I'm really sad that this scene is missing. You know, we'll learn a little bit about them in First Flight, and we've talked about that on the Ready Room before, Chris. But this does a great job of bringing them even closer as friends. And I really, really like that. And I'm sad that, and I'm sure you're right, you know, Enterprise is only about 42 minutes at this point, you know, because of all the commercial breaks that apparently we have to take these days. You lose an even better character moment for those two, and they're not even in the same episode together at the same time.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic thing, so.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that because I did see the scene as well. And, you know, whenever you watch, a director's cut of a movie or something like that, you always hear the director saying, you know, this is one of those scenes I hated to cut out. But, you know, you look back, you watch those, and when you think back on the film or as in this episode, you remember that. And as you watch it over and over again, you remember that cut scene, and you just kind of place that in there when you're watching the episode, and it feels like it fits right in there. And, you know, it's like watching all of the cut scenes of your favorite movies. You know, you remember them, and I'm really glad they made it available for us to watch. And that's why the directors will do that and put that in there, because it's a huge character development scene, especially the respect between those two guys.
I will say the cut works perfectly, though, when you see where they splice here. It's completely seamless. It was really amazing editing.
It really was. I remember watching the scene, and I was like, oh, where are they going to cut this? And there's just that perfect pause, Chris, and it's pretty much the same thing we do in editing a podcast. Somebody gives you that perfect pause, so you never know that something came before that or after that in the way that it does. And I don't know if they directed him like that on purpose or if he just made the pause and that one take that they were able to use. But yeah, it is sad that we're missing this scene, because it's really, really good in the extended version. And in my headcanon, that's there now.
That's a good way to put it, headcanon. I like that.
Headcanon is very famous here on Trek FM.
Yeah.
I even hear everyone's using this now. I mean, you know, Alec and Rob, even Rob Burnett's using headcanon now. So I don't know if we coined that phrase or not. I know that we didn't coin the idea of it, but we've now been saying headcanon for 5 years, and now I'm hearing a lot of people talk about Trek FM's headcanon.
Well, so it's happening a lot with the Star Wars fans right now and the EU and stuff. So it fits perfectly.
Yeah. And if you're an ALF fan, you know, you've got your whole headcanon of what happened at the end of the series when they did that cliffhanger and failed to get renewed. And so we never got the conclusion. So All right. Well, we have well past an hour, so there's a lot more we could talk about here, but let's go ahead and wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings for the episode. So, Daniel, how about you?
Yeah, I like I said in the beginning, I really like this episode a lot. You know, for an episode 90% consisting of just two of our, you know, kind of non-main, they are the main cast, but non-primary cast members, it's really solid. And we get to learn a lot, even if apparently we didn't get to learn all we could have about them. And it's fantastic in its kind of experimentation with this Star Trek formula. Like, for example, in the one Voyager episode where we get Tom and B'Elanna floating through space.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they have all of these intense character moments as well, which is a pretty good episode. But it's like they didn't focus solely on them just floating through space. But that's kind of what they're doing here. So, you know, they are
interesting if they had, though, right? That could be an interesting story.
It definitely could have been. Yeah, yeah, for sure. But it's they spend the time, they take the risk, they shake up the formula enough, and it makes it really interesting. And, you know, on the plus side, we get to know these characters more, who we've barely known for a whole season at this point. And so I think it's a success. To me, it's a success. I imagine, and of course, this is the mantra when we talk about Enterprise, if we had gotten seven seasons of the show, like, we could have said this was the episode where you know, Trip and Malcolm became a friendship, that when they gained broship status. And you can still say that, but of course, you know, it's a little different. And you could trace the hypothetical beginnings of that relationship to this episode. And it would have been amazing to do that. But I love it. I think it's a great episode. I'm gonna give it 4 cranky trips.
Awesome. How about you, Matthew?
Well, I mean, I gave it away at the beginning, but this is one of my favorite episodes of Enterprise and one that I can watch and rewatch constantly because it's just so good. And, you know, it was one of those things where I think Enterprise fired on all cylinders this episode. And I really wish they had been able to find this kind of focus every episode with the characters and really diving in, because I think character focused shows work so much from this point in history onward, and I'm glad that we got this. So I give this 5 out of 5 micro singularities.
Oh, you took my rating. Oh.
Yeah, you always have to have a backup on the ready room because you never know. Never know. And I always go last, so I always have to have a few backups.
I got a backup.
Yeah. All right. How about you, Kevin?
You know, it's funny. When I was watching this episode over again, I think this is the, you know, if you go to a script writing class and they talk about an episode like this, you know, the bottle show, and, you know, your boss is going to ask you to write a show like this if you become a script writer, you know, this is one of those episodes you would have them reference. And I'm a big Friends fan, and there was a classic episode called The One Where Everybody's Late, and it's just Ross trying to get to a black tie affair and trying to get everyone to go on time, and it's just shot.
Oh, yeah.
It's just shot in their apartment, and it's a classic, well written script, and it's probably in the top 5 if you ask Friends of that show. And this episode does that. It you know, develops the characters. It's well written. It's shot on a budget, but the script and the acting is not budget. It's just first class. And I give it 4.5 Kentucky bourbons.
Awesome. If this were a Friends episode, it'd be called The One with the Bourbon.
Yes.
Very good. Yeah, I agree with what you guys have said. There's not a whole lot more to say other than I think that this episode really highlights how strong Enterprise was out of the gate. I think that of all the series, Enterprise, with the exception of the original series, maybe Enterprise has the strongest first season. And I think that's really overlooked because a lot of people didn't watch all of the first season. You know, they tuned out after the first few episodes because the show just didn't connect with them. And you could tell with Enterprise that everyone involved in producing this show had been doing it for so long that it was just a really well-oiled machine. And you can also tell that they had learned, I really think that Brannon had learned some lessons from Voyager in terms of storytelling and wanted to take the show in a bit of a different direction that was better for storytelling. But I think that goes underappreciated by fans. But I think it really shows here. And of course, you know, they went out and they hired great actors. You know, this cast is great, especially these two guys are really excellent. And if you give good actors good material, then you get a really good result, which is what we got here. So I really encourage everyone to go watch this episode again if you haven't seen it in a while. And if you've never seen it before, well, we kind of spoiled it for you. Did we mention that they survive at the end? Spoiler alert.
But, great, Chris. Now I don't even have to watch it.
Yeah, sorry about that, Matthew. But it's just a really, really great episode. And so I'm going to give it 6 hours of boron. Because if you're a Tesnian, you need that every day.
Well played, sir. Well played.
All right. Well, thanks, Kevin and Daniel, for joining us today. So before we go, Kevin, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs.
On Twitter and on Instagram, you can find me at Spartan_Phoenix. That's a reference to Demolition Man, one of my favorite Guilty Pleasure films. I also do a movie blog on Facebook called Spartan Phoenix Movie Blog. And I'm also on Facebook under Kevin Raider Nerd Reitzel.
So I'm just trying to figure out which sports teams you're a fan of. You're wearing an Alabama jersey. I think you live in Atlanta. Is that right?
I live in Atlanta, but I'm from California, and I live
Yeah. And you're a Raiders fan?
Yep.
And then when you said Spartan, I was just thinking, okay, are you a Michigan State fan? What are you going to do coming up here?
Nope. It's all about Demolition Man.
and then Phoenix, you know? I mean, you got the Suns, so okay. It's all about Demolition Man. Very good. All right. Well, it's great to have you on for the first time, Kevin.
Thank you very much. It's been a blast. I appreciate it, Christopher.
So, Daniel, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs and the network.
Well, they can find me here every week on the network's dedicated TNG show, Earl Grey, with my lovely co-hosts, Darren and Philip. We have this kind of fun all the time, talking all things The Next Generation. You can find us every week. And then, of course, around the internet, you can find me on Twitter. And my handle there is 1UpDan. That is the number one, not the word.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chris, I love when we get to talk about fantastic episodes. But I also love when we get to talk about fantastic episodes of Enterprise. Because so many people, especially in that first season, are like, you know, and it's just, it's so good. You know, this episode is so good, and I had a blast getting to talk through it and about the goodness of it, and I was watching it today, and I'm like, I just want to hit the next episode now, watch some more Enterprise.
Yeah, I hope that we had people who stuck around for the whole show. I've noticed that when we do Enterprise episodes on the Ready Room, the overall numbers for those episodes tend to be a little bit lower than the other series, and I think that's because there are just fewer Enterprise fans out there. But I think that's starting to change a little bit. I've noticed it changing, and I think it's thanks to Netflix and the Blu-rays. People are watching this, and also the absence of Star Trek on television for the last decade. People are watching the series now, and they're finding that they like it. And I think we have great discussions about it here on the Ready Room because we have a lot of people on the network, like you and me, who love Enterprise and really appreciate the series. And I hope people stick around for the discussion today. And it was great having Kevin and Daniel on to talk about it as well. And this really is one of the great Enterprise episodes. So let us know what you think about it. What do you think about Shuttle Pod 1? Where is its place within all of Star Trek and within Enterprise? And what do you like about it? What do you dislike? You can post in the Babel Conference, which we mentioned during news. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and type B-A-B-E-L into the search field, and it'll come right up. It is a closed group, so you need to click join, and we'll let you on in. And we have great conversations over there. They're very much an extension of the show here. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. You can go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and use the form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, or send us a voicemail through SpeakPipe at speakpipe.com/TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not trying to see if there's some extra meatloaf in there, I know Trip ate one of them. Where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on Instagram. Trek FM is there now, so make sure you check that out. My username is MRushing. You can find me doing The Orb with you, Chris, where we talk all about Deep Space Nine, which is so much fun. I'm also on the 602 Club talking about all things geeky, so be sure to check that out at, you know, Star Wars, all sorts of talk. And then, of course, I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not busy roaming the Enterprise looking for the gremlins that are apparently hidden somewhere in the shuttle bay, where can we find you?
Yeah, well, you'll find me watching gremlins. I'm surprised
that's
that
what you're doing. You're not looking for gremlins. You're just watching gremlins.
That's right. I think that on one of the Enterprise movie nights, they should have actually shown gremlins, and that way T'Pol would understand a little bit better what was being referenced there. That would have been good. Anyway, well, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere in social media. You can find me in the Babel Conference, of course, talking to all the listeners about Star Trek over there. And elsewhere on the network, you'll find me, of course, doing The Orb with you, Matthew, as you mentioned, and then also doing our short news show Hyper Channel from time to time, and Continuing Mission, which is about independent productions and fan films. You can find me behind the scenes producing the Axanar podcast, the official Axanar podcast. And then if you want to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name, it's probably the easiest way, C. Brian Jones, and my column will come up there. And then also I do another podcast, which is not about Star Trek, called Metropolis on Air. And that's tied to the magazine that I run here in Tokyo. And you can find that in iTunes and other places by just searching for Metropolis on Air. Matthew, before we go, I want to really thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room. They help us keep this show coming to you guys, and also they support the whole network as well. And that's Renee Roberts, a very lovely lady who has been with us for years and years now here on the network. And we really could not do this without Renee. Thank you so much, Renee, for your support. You can find her on Twitter. Her username there is Mares_1701. And then also Zachary Fruling, who listeners to the show know because he's on here from time to time. Zachary also hosts Metatrex, our newest show with Mike Morrison. And Zachary is an associate producer here on The Ready Room. You can find him on Twitter. His username is Zachary Fruling, his exact name. And Fruling is Fruhling. So Renee and Zachary, thank you both so much for supporting the show. And if you're listening and you want to become an associate producer, or you just want to contribute to the network in some way, the way that we do that is through Patreon, and that's at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can contribute any amount that you want on a month-to-month basis, and we have a lot of different perks over there. We have a great website called Patron Zone, which is set up just for our patrons. We do early show releases there. We do other exclusive content. We have wallpapers and ringtones and avatars, and we do all sorts of things there. All of our perks are available all the time, and the password for that site changes month to month. So if you sign up as a patron, you'll get access to everything for an entire month. And we really do need your support to keep the show coming and all the shows on the network, because we're listener supported. And without your help, we won't be able to talk about Star Trek and we won't be able to bring you the podcasts. So we hope you'll check that out. Patreon.com/TrekFM is the URL. And we really thank everyone so much for their support. With the holidays coming up, don't forget about our store on Redbubble, trek.fm/store or trekfm.link/trekfmstore, or search for us on Redbubble, trek.fm. Matthew, what's your favorite design that we have there in the store right now?
Oh gosh, Chris, it has to be the word cloud. I got that shirt and I love it. One, it is my favorite Enterprise, which is the Refint Enterprise. That's the word bubble there. And it has all of our shows. So I don't just represent one of them or just my show, but every time I wear that shirt, I'm representing all of Trek FM with my person, and I love that that was my first purchase. It's a great design there by Aaron. I couldn't be more happy with getting to sport my Trek FM fandom all over the place now.
Yeah, that's a really cool design. I think I might get that in the future as a sticker and put that on my MacBook, because I have this kind of plastic hard shell covering on my MacBook Pro, so I can carry it around without making it really thick. And right now I have the Star Wars travel stickers.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
I don't
know
if you've seen those, but I have those on the back of my computer. But down the road, I may do another hard shell, and I think the word cloud would be an awesome sticker,
definitely,
network sticker to put on there. Be really, really cool. So go check those out, everyone. Great, great holiday gift items. Oh, and we have holiday cards now, too. We have this really cool new design shaped like a Christmas tree, but with Star Trek elements all throughout. And that's available as a gift card in our store.
It's so funny, Chris. You know, everybody's been posting on the Babel Conference all of their Star Trek ornaments. So I put a big album together of all mine because I have so many of them. And Aaron comment on that. He's like, hey, that looks like our Christmas card. And I'm like, pretty much my tree looks just like that.
Your real life version of our holiday card. That's pretty cool. All right. Well, Matthew, I'm going to go wander to the back of the shuttle and see if there's any bourbon left in that bottle, because, you know, maybe there's still a sip left after they got picked up by the Enterprise.
Well, Chris, there's never a bad time for bourbon. So I applaud you for that decision, and I think it's time to stick a wayward micro-singularity in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Okay, so the hope and the pessimism. I cannot pronounce this word today. I don't know what the hell's wrong with me. Okay.
Pessimism.
Pessimism.
Pessimism, yes. Captain!
That's exactly what I was about to say.
A really, pessimism, really deep
and
frown.
The frown is still like this.
Pessimism!
That is the Phlox you do. That's the Mirror Universe Phlox.
Mirror Universe Phlox, yeah.
Ironically, if you say it with pep, it's easier to say it.
No, I think you have to go down. Pessimism, Captain.
That would be awesome. Okay, let me transition this. Okay.